Coming up next, Arnab talks about Vikas Dubey, Kanye and immigration.
They are asking the policy question and the CPM question.
Hi, this is episode 91 of Attention Plus with Arnab Ray, and we are recording on the 12th of July 2020 and I am Vikram Mohan. A word about the other podcast from Foursquare, Binge On, one of our popular ones, which has theme-based recommendations on stuff to watch, is on a break. And we'll be back in a couple of weeks with some tweaks and some changes, which we hope you'll love. But meanwhile, if you haven't listened to any of them yet, you can look for recommendations from the older episodes where we have covered English, Hindi, Tamil, Telugu, Malayalam, movies, documentaries, series, and a whole lot more. So head to foursquare.net. That's the number 4, SPIRE.net. And now, since the title of this podcast is Attention Plus with Arnab Ray, here's the man you want to listen to, Arnab Ray. Hey, Arnab.
Hi. Hello, everybody. And welcome to the 91st episode of the Attention Plus podcast.
Getting close to the three-digit.
Getting close to the three-digit. I hope that we have something special that we can do for our 100th episode, though I have absolutely no idea what that would be. Anyways,
In COVID,
you have any ideas?
If we survive for 100, I think that itself is an achievement.
Yes, if I survive for the next 8 or 9 weeks, that again will be an achievement considering where I stay. So for today, I just wanted to have a more focused on US politics and US elections and desi immigration to the US. Originally, I planned to have guests here, but the guests couldn't be here because of, they had some personal problem today. So we hope to get them in a subsequent episode where we will be talking with in great depth about the H-1B problem and the F-1 problem and what it actually is, the technicalities of it, much of which I don't know. So I'll be getting an expert to talk on the whole immigration thing. People complain that, I haven't done any episode on desis in the US, and I think I have done quite a few where I have talked about immigration specifically, of course. Not to this level of detail that I will be hopefully having people come in and talk about in future episodes, but I'll try to touch upon this this week if my rambling is finished within an appropriate amount of time. So I want to start off with something which was very Indian, with the encounter death of Vikas Dubey. So I had been so tempted the day before he was encountered, air quotes, to actually tweet. I had composed the tweet and then I actually had deleted it, that I am giving this guy 7 days. And I thought, God knows, in this day of social media outrage, whether that would cause an outrage or not. So I took it back. I saw that some people had predicted the exact same thing, that, I'm giving this guy 7 days, essentially. Vikas will have 7 days. And I was wrong. He didn't even have 24 hours at that point of time. So again, there's a lot of cheering. And this is unfortunate. This is an unfortunate concomitant of the glorification of police violence in Hindi movies, which is fun. And I'm not saying that we don't like to see villains getting their comeuppance and being encountered. But in this case, the main thing to understand that it's not really Vikas Dubey who was being killed. He wasn't being killed because this was justice or this was righteous. He was being killed because he had to be silenced. That's fairly obvious, that whenever criminals who operate at that level in that state, get caught, that is the first and that is the most important thing. And actually, this was one of the reasons this is kind of common knowledge why Dawood Ibrahim was never brought back to India. India could have done that at that point of time when he first escaped. But I think the sauda there was that if he did come back, he would take names. And I don't think anybody in the Indian political establishment wanted him to take names. So I think that, with respect to Dawood Ibrahim, it was, and Dawood himself, in this last interview, he said that he would come back to India, but he was afraid for his life. And he should have been also, given the fact that, you know, the amount of people he knew from both from Indian politics as well as from the Indian film industry, he had enough leverage. And, you know, there was just too many people who would not want him to open his mouth in the courtroom. And, you know, he was a big deal. This guy wasn't that big a deal. And even he couldn't, you know, the amount of secrets that this guy was sitting on, I presume, were less valuable than the amount of secrets that Dawood Ibrahim was sitting on. But as you can see, that didn't save him at all. So this actually speaks a lot to the, you know, we're talking about police violence, and, you know, in a previous podcast, I had also touched upon police violence as
it relates to... This was during the Hyderabad rape.
This was in Tamil Nadu when this father and this son were sodomized.
Right, that too.
And you know, this kind of absolute power we're talking about, you know, Black Lives Matters and people are outraged about that, and rightfully so. But in Indian policing is even more terrible, and the absolute power that they enjoy, and the fact that it's so obvious that this person was killed. There was no accident or anything of that sort. And, you know, this guy who didn't look like he was a guy who was going to try to escape, and especially from the rubble of a truck of a car which had turned over. Anyways, it's so obvious, and yet we know that nothing is going to happen. That's almost a given. I don't think anybody even rationally expects that the killers of Vikas Dubey will be brought to justice, because we kind of tend to have an understanding that somebody like Vikas Dubey, who's obviously guilty and obviously a murderer himself, that he does not deserve justice. And maybe, you know, maybe he doesn't, but the fact is that the fact that he's being killed is to prevent justice from being served to people who are much bigger than he is. And that's something which we should understand. This is what happens when you get behind this kind of encounter justice. It might seem to be immediately to be instant justice, but the fact is this is actually a cover-up. It's very obviously a cover-up, and we will never know who were the people behind him. And I presume that the names would be pretty significant. Though obviously not as significant as what Dawood Ibrahim would say. Anyways, so moving towards the main country for today, I wanted to talk a little bit about U.S. elections. And it's U.S. elections are in, presidential elections are in November. And this is something which is unprecedented in American history as well. Of course, something which I have never seen is that it's the middle of July almost, and there's absolutely no buzz about the U.S. elections, none whatsoever. By this time, there would be wall-to-wall presidential debates, and there would be all this hoopla about the presidential elections. There would be a Democratic convention, there would be a Republican convention. It would just be, you know, one entire political circus. This an election year summer is ratings gold for all the TV news channels, and now, you know, it's totally off the headlines, in the US at this point of time. And this, of course, is something which worries. This is to the advantage of Biden and to the great worry of Trump, because Trump thrives on television coverage and positive television coverage. He wants to go up on television and bully other people. And, you know, that's what gets him like hard, actually. So to use a vulgarity, but that's the thing that came to my mind. And he's just, he's not getting there at this point of time, because he's forced inside, and you know, nobody really cares. And he's tried to kind of do some rallies, and each of those rallies have been disastrous in the sense that people didn't show up. People who showed up then got COVID. So it's obviously something which is not sustainable. And this obviously also is working to the advantage of Joe Biden, because Joe Biden is the guy who you don't want to put on stage, because he is, you know, habitually, this is not something which is new, but obviously has gotten worse with age, is that he does a lot of malapropisms. Essentially, he just misspeaks before all this, he got confused between his wife and his sister. Okay, so his level of confusion. Yes, so he introduced his sister as his wife, and yes, when they were right in front of him. So this is the level of his confusion. So obviously, the more he gets and stands up in front of him, and Trump was actually looking forward to this. The only person he wouldn't really like to meet on a stage would have been Bernie, because Bernie is just like Trump. So you can say whatever you want against Bernie. Bernie will just shout over you and, you know, wag his fingers. But Joe Biden is somebody who is the kind of guy that Trump would relish going after on a one-on-one, because he would stumble and he would possibly say something. Of course, he's kind of a gunda himself, Biden, but he's like an aging gunda, and he wouldn't really be able to take. One thing that you have to say about Trump is that when it comes to bullying, he's still at the top of his game. So that's something which he's really good at. I don't know if any of you have been following, but there was this tell-all. There's a lot of tell-all books that are coming out right now in the Trump presidency, telling all about Trump. So there's not really much to be told anymore. But this was written by his niece. Have you heard of this, Vikram?
No, not at all.
Yes. So there was this tell-all book which came out, written about Trump by his niece, where essentially what the niece said was that his elder brother's daughter. She said the thing about Trump was that, you know, their father was exactly like Trump, and he used to bully his kids, just like Trump bullies his kids. And all the children had to basically lie to get approval of their father. Like, all of them knew they were in line to get a lot of money. So, you know, which of them would get more money? So they would kind of fight among themselves, like lying about the other person and exaggerating their own achievements. And that's the book in which he basically accused Trump of having hired somebody else to sit for his SAT exams. This is total,
I didn't
total
know that
Bihar elections, a total Bihar examinations, essentially.
I didn't know that.
Yes. So this and that's why she said that, you know, he's like a you know, lying comes second nature to him. And, you know, she's a psychoanalyst. So she said, you know, this is a part of his like total dysfunctional childhood. And even my dad was part of that. And, you know, he was among all the sons, he was the best in lying and, you know, exaggerating his own achievements, which is what he's done throughout his life. So the main thing is, it's basically his dad who kind of taught all of them and kind of encouraged this behavior. Anyway, so it's I haven't read the book, of course. I have no intent of, but you know, the extracts were pretty salacious, I would say. Including Trump attempting to hit on his niece.
But here's the thing. I mean, even before this, we've had loads of people with information. None of this sticks to him, right? I mean, you had the entire grabbing incident, Hollywood. He just comes out unscathed. So how will this hurt him when other
people... No, this doesn't hurt him. So you see, for his fan base, he's kind of... His image is kind of like Salman Khan. Right? As I've said this before. So he's basically impervious to reviews. And any of these things, ultimately, they actually work in his favor, bizarrely. Because to his fans, this is like kitna bara mard hai. Like, this is really the way that his fan base thinks about him. It's a very regressive, so it's an extremely regressive section of the US society which forms his core base. And for them, you know, they will say, okay, maybe, and if you ask them face to face, and there were many interviews where people asking, why do you like this? And even with evangelicals, who are like the most conservative of Christians, who like will not talk to a woman who is not their wife unless their wife is present, apparently. And even they said, look, you know, essentially, they say, of course, he's a sinner. But, you know, when people find things to justify, they'll do whatever they want. Listen, he's a sinner and he's a fornicator. But, you know, that's just something between him and Lord Jesus. So, you know, who are we to say anything about that? So that's between him and his own personal God. As we see it, he's a great president in terms of the rule that he brings to us. As a person, what he is and what he does, you know, that's... Suddenly, hardcore Christian conservatives become extremely liberal in terms of, let's not judge him for his personal life and his choices. while they do that exactly the same thing to everybody else.
Right.
But for this guy, we will not judge him on his personal choices. We'll take the moral high ground. And so the only thing that we are concerned about is his presidency and how he does his job. And as a human being, of course, I have nothing to say on. Of course, he's not a great human being. Let's all accept that. But that's a value judgment. And I'm not voting based on a value judgment. Like, wow, you know, what a subtle point. Anyways, so coming back to the US elections, I think the fun thing was Kanye West announcing his presidency. Of course, it's not serious. He's too late, actually, for most places. And it's not even important. The fact is that Kanye West just, in the US, what's happened is like, the only thing that I can think of is this ultimately resembles at this point of time, the last days of the Roman Empire. So if you have read about the Roman Empire, this is pretty much what happened in the last days of the Roman Empire. So what happened in the last days of Roman Empire was that they amassed a lot in the amount of wealth that they had amassed from conquering other places was such that everybody had this basically too much money. And all the actual work was done by slaves. So they basically had nothing to do. They ate and drank all day. And there was an oligarchy, essentially, which was a rule of rich people. And then there was the people who slaved and did the work. But this oligarchy was the ruling class, which is exactly what the US is today. It's like a pitch perfect description of what the US has become. And it was ruled by a number of people. And, you know, as we had pictures of Trump playing golf, all you can think of was Nero at this point of time. And there was this desire for obscene desire for spectacles. So that was why, you know, people were thrown to the lions in the Colosseum. The only thing that people liked and what people and how the rulers were popular was they would organize more and more bizarre spectacles, essentially Instagram baits, that kind of things. So, you know, however more bizarre the spectacle, including like throwing people to the lions, public orgies, you know, things which were okay in those days. So what we have is Kanye West is kind of like a Roman oligarch. Okay. He resembles a Roman oligarch. So what he does is he wants to throw a spectacle. I think that, you know, in COVID times, he can't do the spectacle. If this was a normal times, then this would be an amusing side note. But again, given that when Trump's campaign started, people said the same thing about Trump, that this was actually Trump trying to get a reality show because they canceled Apprentice. They chucked him out of Apprentice. This was he trying to pitch a reality show to a rival network. This is presumably how his whole presidential candidacy started. Even he wasn't serious about winning. He was thinking that it would allow him to do some of this kind of circusing that has become de rigueur to get attention in the US, which is exactly what it was in the last days of the Roman Empire. And then the Huns and the Goths and the Ostrogoths, they all attacked the, you know, when they realized that, you know, okay, this was a country which would not be able to defend itself, they basically came and attacked. And the Romans got robbed time after time, time after time, time after time. And of course, that doesn't happen to the US from actual human beings. They're being attacked by microscopic virus particles. So that's the analog. And that's exactly how the US empire is most likely going to die. And we see it. You know, this COVID again is something which the US never really accounted for. And while most other countries have been able to flatten the curve, this is the only country in the world where cases keep shooting up, like straight line up and up and up and up. And why is this happening? So this is happening because, and this is happening in the states of Texas, Arizona, Florida, and California. Of course, because of the extremely politically polarized nature of the US politics, which is, of course, for those of you who listen to this podcast, know that Indian politics is now a perfect reflection of this polarization. Most of the media does not cover the terrible thing in California. They want to focus on the Republican states. And But the fact is that it's really, really crazy in these four states at this point of time in terms of people falling sick. Now, what makes California slightly different from the other states is that in all the other states, the governors have been denying the seriousness of COVID from day one. That is, they have themselves, because they are dependent on Trump, they have repeatedly said that this was something which was going to go away. The threat of COVID-19 was being overblown, that this was all a conspiracy to get Trump out of office. So they just did the kind of bootlicking that Republicans have to do nowadays, because Trump is insanely popular still within the Republican Party, and there is very few people who can oppose Trump and still be in the Republican Party, because he's basically taken over the Republican Party, just like, you know, the COVID virus takes over your lungs. So the Republican governors also, it's not clear whether they're stupid enough to actually follow Trump's line, but their public pronouncements were that, you know, something, there is this great video taken about a month ago where the Florida governor DeSantis, an interviewer asks some question, and he kind of shouts at him Trump style and says, you know, 7-8 weeks ago, you guys were saying that this place was going to become like New York, like within 3 weeks. And it's been 8 weeks since you said that. Where is it? You know, stop your shit. This kind of thing doesn't happen. Well, now it is happening. And this has been triggered. And it's happening in, as I said, it's happening in California. And in California, the thing is, most of the state is actually under pretty good control. It's just where I stay, Los Angeles, that's really the Los Angeles County is the biggest county in the US. So even in terms of numbers, there's going to be a lot of COVID cases, and it's an extremely congested place. So in terms of density, very, very high density, lot of people, and Los Angeles County and the surrounding counties like Orange County, San Bernardino County, Riverside County, these are all the red zones within California. Actually, the northern area, the Bay Area, San Francisco, they are pretty okay. They, for some reason, I would say, not, let's just say it's not some reason, in those places, most of the, it's an extreme, because of the Silicon Valley and because of all the startups and, you know, the Googles and Facebooks of the world, that place has essentially become the haven of extremely rich people. I mean, middle-class Americans can no longer live there. Unless you're on a 500K a year salary, you just can't live there. And for people who are living that kind of, you know, $1 million family salary is basically most people are making. I'm not saying most, but a lot of people there are making at least the average family's income there would be 250 to 300K minimum to live a decent life in San Francisco Bay Area. Not saying a very luxurious life, but like a normal desi middle class life, you know, that kind of life, you'll need that amount of salary. So because of that, and because their companies allow them to work from home, and because there's not a lot of, you know, it just doesn't have that composition of people. It's just not so many people, and they're not that level of beaches and stuff there. Not a lot of things to do also. So it has been constrained. In Los Angeles, because of the number of beaches and because of the general Los Angeles lifestyle, which is very, very outdoor, and it's fueled by young people, this is why Los Angeles, place with beach, Florida, place with a lot of beaches, you know, these places have become the hotspots. And it's at this time, this curve up is being driven by exclusively by young people. The first time when people started getting sick, it was basically everybody, because nobody knew, right? People were living normal lives. But even in California, even in Los Angeles, this new surge of coronavirus cases is driven by very, very young people, like in their 20s, falling sick. And the tragedy is that many of them are dying also. That's the thing. It's not, as people say, that young people, of course, the number of people dying is obviously lesser if you're younger and if you don't have pre-existing conditions. But because of how mysterious this disease is, that you know, people, there's some big bizarre things that are happening to people. Like even after they test negative for COVID, they, you know, people are saying that people who could like do, they could run like 10 miles easy, they get tired after a mile. They still just, they feel that they're short of breath. And so they're afraid that, you know, they, it has damaged them permanently. And just because it's so new, there's been no clinical studies of anything of what the long-term effect of a COVID will be on people who have ostensibly recovered from it. It's, this is not a disease which doesn't leave a mark. It's like, tere chehre par asar chhod jaunga, that kind of, Inkinan kind of song, disease it is. It will leave an effect on you. So, yeah, when I read that, that's the song which played in my mind, which just goes to show how much in the 90s I am. Anyways, so the question is, why are the Republicans so obsessed about opening the economy? Well, they are obsessed about opening the economy because they have realized that Trump's only electoral hope is the economy. Like as long as, you know, shops remain closed, obviously there will be jobs which are lost. And obviously there will be people who will not be making money. And so, of course, when people die, that's going to be the same thing. But their main thing is that if people die, it will take me a few more months. And if I close the shop, then I lose jobs today. So, of course, politicians and I would say even people who in the upper levels of corporate management, they always are greedy in the short term. They're never greedy in the long term. So they just want to make sure that today everything is as okay as possible. Kal ka kya hoga, dekha jayega tab. We'll just kick the can down the road. So Trump's only electoral hope is economy. And, you know, he's currently in the middle of a very, very tough electoral season. And most likely he's going to lose. The only way he can turn this around is if people feel happy with him. And if, and this is again something which I have said before, when people go to vote for someone, it is not, they don't vote based on GDP or job numbers or employment numbers. They vote purely on their happiness. Okay, it's a emotional decision. I don't think most people, they don't make an Excel sheet and look positives and negatives and decide who they're going to vote. It is mostly something, even for undecided voters, it happens from a sense of wellness. Okay, if I have a good feeling about this person. And Trump knows that if the economy is closed, and if people can't go and get a haircut, or if people can't go and sit in a bar and talk, he's perfectly okay with people dying, by the way, because, you know, if people die, that's okay. They won't come back and vote, right? So, you know, dying is a terminal condition that he's not concerned about. But he's more concerned about the people who won't die, who will be pissed off that they haven't been able to go to a bar and have a drink. And that they, and this is really the Trump core voters, you know, their memory is basically one bit. So obviously they're not the smartest tools in the box. So for them, the fact that they can't go out and have a drink and they're not being able to watch NASCAR and they're not able to go and watch a baseball game in the stadium, these things will create in them a sense of dissatisfaction that will turn out to be a negative vote for Trump. Even with his other things that they love about Trump, that just their sense of being pissed off will ultimately, and so this is the reason, and this is something which is so dangerous, that Trump now wants the schools to be opened. He wants all schools to be opened. He wants my daughter, these people to go to schools. You know, knowing very well that if they go to school, they will, you know, kids, they're not going to obey social distancing, right? You know, 7-year-olds and 6-year-olds are not going to obey social distancing. So they will pick up the disease. They will come back and transmit it to their parents. And we are seeing now that, you know, it's not that children aren't, they are living through COVID, but they're also coming out with severe damage through COVID. So it's not something which is of zero impact to children. But of course, Trump doesn't give a flying fuck about children, unless they are his own. And even then, he's selective about who cares about. There are some of his children that he doesn't care about either. So, and he's getting this Betsy DeVos, who's the education secretary. She's like the living embodiment of Dolores Umbridge from Harry Potter. You know, they believe that they want to open schools. And their main thing is that, you know, okay, if schools open in September, the shit won't really hit till November. I mean, people will start dying by the thousands in November if they open the school. That time election will be over, right? So, kaam to ho gaya tha. So So let's just open it in September so that there is this normalcy is returned. So by before the elections, their main thing is that everything should be open. It doesn't matter how many people are falling sick, because these numbers, in any case, what's happened is, and this is why Trump has stopped kind of giving these daily briefings, because his advisors have told him that if he keeps on giving these daily briefings, then he'll have to talk about the numbers. And the numbers, and he will himself be keeping these numbers in the public consciousness. Now that there hasn't been a briefing for weeks, people, and most people are totally, unless they're people like me, most people even don't know what the case count is at this point of time. So the advice has been, initially, why did Trump do it? Trump wanted to do it because once this whole thing struck, he wanted to be seen as a savior. Then he realized quickly that there is, it's too far gone. This is not a Hollywood scripted story that the president will take. You know, he's not Harrison Ford that he will go and, or he will not like the Independence Day guy that he will take his plane and fight the aliens. So that's not going to happen. That this is just something too big for him to deal with. So now that he's realized that the battle has been lost essentially and people are going to die, he's doing what successive American presidents have done. When battles go south, whether it be Vietnam or Iraq war, they have decided to stop talking about it at this point of time. As George Bush did, he declared victory in that battleship, and then he stopped talking about it. And then they lost the battle. So this is exactly what the US has happened with the battle with COVID-19 in the US. Trump, you know, alpha male number one, has kind of run away with his tail between his legs. And he is trying desperately for people to forget that, you know, that's why also that he's so resistant to wearing a mask. He was forced to wear a mask today, and he said he would only wear a mask if the mask had a presidential seal on it and nobody else had it. So you can understand the level of maturity of the guy who has the nuclear button at this point of time.
Today's, the paper had a photo of him with a mask for the first time.
Yeah, so that's the thing. That mask has a presidential seal on it. And his thing was that he will wear a mask only if it is a unique one made for him with the presidential seal on it. So as I said, this is the level of maturity that he has.
Just to give a parallel, my four-year-old refused to wear a mask unless it had Peppa Pig or Mickey Mouse. So yes. You have that.
And now give your four-year-old the nuclear button.
Exactly.
With Biden, so let's come to a different topic on Trump versus Biden. Is who's good for India? This was always a, you know, when I was in India, all my first question was, in any presidential election, who would be the better for India? Who will be better for India is Trump. Trump is obviously much better for India. Biden is good for Indians in America. These are two totally different things. So why is Trump good for India? Well, first of all, Trump and the people who are behind him, they basically hate all brown-skinned people. There's no doubt about that. And they're too ignorant to even make distinctions between like different countries. For them, all of us are the same. So America for them is for white Caucasians. That's always been Make America Great Again is basically a, you know, widely accepted wolf whistle for Make America White Again. As long as Indians are not in the US, and this is reflected in his policy in H-1B and in F-1 now, he is perfectly fine with Indians. He's perfectly fine with Indians as long as they're in India. He is very, as a matter of fact, he's actually sympathetic to India's foreign policy objectives. So right now, who are India's biggest enemies? Firstly, China, and second, Pakistan. So Pakistan is, to him, it's indistinguishable from India. He doesn't even know what the difference between India and Pakistan is. But since the Pakistani guy hasn't thrown like a big stadium event for him, he will go with the Indian guy for this, for now. Unless Imran Khan does something, and Imran Khan has tried to be very obsequious to Trump and kind of grovel. But unless Imran Khan, you know, essentially brings out his black lentil and, you know, gives Trump that black lentil treatment, I don't think, and I somehow think that Trump will not enjoy it so much as Imran Khan does, you know, right now between Pakistan and India, India've kind of got the inside track on Trump and the only way you get the inside track on Trump is being obsequious to him. And that's the only thing he understands. And I think India has done a better job on that. with respect to giving Trump the importance that he greatly craves, like any child who's like 5 year old. So for Indians, actually, Trump is much better. And with specifically with respect to India's relationship with China, nowadays Trump is pissed off with China because he's gotten into his head. There are two reasons why he's pissed off with China. First of all, he believes that China screwed him with this coronavirus. Ultimately, the only prism that he understands the world through is whether somebody has done something bad to him or good to him. That's the only thing he cares. He doesn't care for anybody else or people dying or anything. Right now, China fucked me over with this coronavirus thing. That's all his simple six-year-old boy brain can comprehend. So given that China is fighting against India and is kind of locked in this confrontation with it, he's obviously he will take India's side at this point of time. Just because he believes that China has done something bad to him and India hasn't done anything bad to him. As a matter of fact, India, when he asked for chloroquine tablets, India exported the tablets to him. So Modi is his friend. That's true. When Modi wished him July 4th and he retweeted it, it's genuinely true. Trump genuinely likes Modi. There's no two ways about it. Especially India would find that Trump is much more sympathetic to India on issues like Article 370 and Kashmir. Because again, in terms of as long as Indians stay in India, he is perfectly fine with furthering India's foreign policy objectives, especially if it relates to China, his enemy number one at this point of time, because they have hurt him. Now, Biden is actually exactly the other way around. See, Biden belongs to the other ruling class of the US, where it's also this very, very Caucasian-centric, Europe-centric America. But they just don't articulate it that way. They're basically as racist. And actually, Biden has made fun of Indian accents before, publicly. Okay. And so he's in a way no better in these respects. But his bigotry is not the bigotry of Bannon and Trump. His bigotry is slightly different. His bigotry is the bigotry of low expectations. He's perfectly fine with Indians coming to the US with a begging bowl. Okay. As long as Indians come to the US, India as a country, as long as they're in, this is kind of reflected in that New York Times cartoon where they, India is a place with open toilets, how dare they want to send a man to the moon or spacecraft to Mars. So this is that kind of New York Times racism is what characterizes Joe Biden. It's a very different kind of racism than what characterizes Trump. And racism itself is a multi-hued thing. So and this was true for Hillary Clinton also. So what he's going to do is he's going to lecture India. He is going to lecture India as a country, especially with respect to environmental record, with respect to, and he will take much more seriously the Indian journalists who are planting anti-India stories in the big newspapers in the US. So Trump doesn't read, can't give a fuck, and he hates Washington Post anyways for other reasons because they go after him. So anything that happens in Washington Post, New York Times, he doesn't read. As a matter of fact, if they write something negative about someone, that's a positive to him. This is not the way Biden will react. So this is going to be with a Biden presidency is much better to Pakistan. It's really what Pakistan would want. Because this allows a Biden presidency allows Pakistan to bring their lobbyists into play. It will allow them to use Indian journalists to basically have their talking points be published in international fora and international newspapers. So all of this influence mongering, this thing will work much better under Biden, but Biden will be more sympathetic to Indian immigrants in general, because that is a Democrat platform. So in general, but and we'll come to this at the end, that on immigration, this is something which both the Republicans and Democrats fundamentally at some point they agree on. They're not very hot on Indian Americans coming to US for different reasons. So he will be much more, in general, the person, the people who will benefit most under a Biden presidency would be U.S. citizens who are of Indian origin. Because in general, there will be much more, you know, there will be specific avenues given to promote their diversity in America. Indian Americans in general will have an easier way up under a Biden presidency that they will not normally have under Trump. As I said, Trump's main problem is with brown people who think of themselves as Americans. That's his major problem. That's not Biden's major problem. Biden's major problem are Indian citizens in India who are trying to be like Americans. That's his main problem. He belongs to that class of Democrats who believes that they have the right, America has the right to pollute the world as they wish. But when Indians want to have cars, you should have carbon emissions. You should have, you know, carbon tax there. So, you know, this is the kind of bigotry that Biden and his group represent. It's a very different kind of bigotry from Trump's. Trump's is more, you know, in your face thing. But again, Trump is much more sympathetic. He's not sympathetic because he's a better person or anything. And if anything, that Trump represents the nadir of what humanity can be. But the fact is, he doesn't care. And as long as it's not something which is affecting his own business, as a matter of fact, Trump would actually like to open, you know, a Trump Tower in Bangalore or someplace. So once you have, you know, Trump towers and Trump properties in India, you can trust him that Trump will be the most pro-India person possible. Biden, on the other hand, he doesn't work that way. He works from a very, very different ideological center than, you know, how much money he's making. And of course, this would have been even worse if this was Bernie Sanders, as it should be very, very obvious. So this brings us to something which I just wanted to touch upon. We'll be discussing this in greater detail in a subsequent episode, is the recent H-1B and ICE diktat on F-1B. So let's just summarize what they were for those of you who haven't been following the story. So about a month or so ago, Trump passed an executive order. So executive order is basically something which the president signs, so it doesn't go through Congress. It's not voted upon, which stopped all H-1B renewals. So in the US, there is something which is very, very unique in the sense that your work permit and your visa are two separate entities. So there is the H-1B work permit and there's an H-1B visa. So it's very possible, and it often happens to people, that they have their H-1B work permit, but their H-1B visa has expired, which means they can legally work in the US, but if they leave the country, they can't come back in, which is bizarre, right? It doesn't make any sense. If you have a work permit, you should be allowed to come back into the country, but and the whole purpose of this is basically to inconvenience and to anybody who wants to work and stay in the country. That's been fairly obvious and has been part of US's immigration policies for decades through Republicans and Democrats. So right now, what Trump did was he kind of summarily decided that all the US consulates will stop issuing H-1B visas. So anybody who is on an H-1B has gone to India because they wanted to get their H-1B stamped and come in, they basically cannot come in. And so if you were unlucky to have been either be waiting for a new H-1B in India or had gone there to get your H-1B visa stamped to renew, you're effed at this point of time. So that was something which he did. Again, is this a long-term solution? So the opponents of the H-1B program say that it sounds fairly okay that this is, you know, America doesn't need foreign workers at this point of time with so many jobs lost. We should prioritize Americans, which is perfectly fine. But none of these measures are actually going to do that. None of these measures are actually going to make any significant dent in this problem at all. This is just something which is red meat to Trump's Bannon base of dispossessed white software engineers who blame India. This is just right now, he's election time and he wants to keep all of his base happy. So this is that red meat to that base. And the second red meat to that base was the ICE dict. So ICE, which is notorious, which is actually one of the most notorious agencies in the US because they're kind of directly responsible for dragging illegal immigrants out of their houses and deporting them. For some reason that I haven't understood, they're actually the ones who administer the student visa program. So what the Trump administration did was, they didn't start something new. So the US has had this long-standing, you know, rule that if you are taking an fully online course in US, you cannot come and stay in the US. This was done for a perfectly good reason. In the US, there are a lot of these online universities, which are, you know, not that great universities, but they provide you full online degrees. So this was done so that in people who want to migrate from India and China, they just can't sign up. But obviously the standards are non-existent to these online universities and then use that to come to the US. This was the reason, and it would have made total sense. But of course, now with COVID, that it should be obvious that with you know, Harvard and MIT and, you know, the whole UC system going to full online, obviously this is no longer true. So what ICE did was they said that anybody who's coming into the US with an admit to an university which is fully online, we are going to enforce that rule and you cannot come in. Not only that, and this is where it went even beyond what was done for H-1B, even those who were inside US, even they will have to leave the country if their university has gone fully online. So at least for H-1B, they did not make those who are in the country leave. But for students who are perhaps the most vulnerable population when it comes to immigrants, they decided to do that. And this was like a double-edged sword. So on one hand, this was like a win-win situation for Trump and the Republican administration. So on one hand, if the US universities depend for their tuition a lot on Indian and Chinese, mostly Indian students at this point of time. So what they're trying to do is they're trying to pressurize these universities to open, because then they will then lose the tuition of all these students, right? If they are fully online. So again, this comes back to Betsy DeVos and Trump. The urge to restore normalcy. They want these universities to open, irrespective of the human cost of what will happen as a result of them opening the university. As I said, this is not something which they even care for, which shows the absolute cynicism and of almost this Nazian cynicism and for life, that, and I don't use this word lightly, that Trump now has, that they're just willing to let people die, knowing fully well there's no more ignorance now that we don't know how serious COVID-19 is. That could have been an excuse in March. It's not an excuse in July. But they actually want to make schools and universities stay open so that Trump can win the election. So by doing this, they are firstly pressurizing American universities to not go fully online so that they actually have classes. Even though the classes are not required, all of us know that for many programs which don't have labs and, you know, software programs, programming and most of these things, they can do it fully remotely nowadays. Even labs now, they have simulations of, you know, everything is now simulated, right? So you don't have to. This is not like in the 1990s. So there is no educational reason why an online learning would be bad. But what the Trump administration is relying on is that the US universities are not going to allow all of this tuition to go to waste. So they are going to open their universities because of this. And if they don't, if they decide to prioritize the life of their students over money, which they're hoping that they won't, because they would never do that themselves, then, you know, fuck them. The Indians can go home. We don't care, and we don't want them in this country. So they win either way at this point of time. So this is kind of a win-win move for them. And as I have been saying over the last year, the 2 years, how many episodes? 91. So it should almost be 2 years that I've been having this podcast. The very first day I've been saying the Trump's administration's main focus is not illegal immigrants. Mind you, they haven't done anything remotely close to this in terms of taking out illegal immigrants in the country. Yes, they have done family separation. Even family separation was basically something which was, again, a red meat to their base, to show this egregious acts of cruelty, to make them feel happy as if something was done. But with respect to actually the problem of illegal immigration, they have done nothing. All that they have done is they have come down hard on legal immigrants, which were on the day one, who were their real targets, and especially Indian immigrants. They have come down hardest. They were among those targets. They were the ones that had the target drawn on their backs. And this is the tragedy of the H-1B and the green card program for Indian immigrants to the US. Because this is something which, and we've been talking about the Republicans a lot and not so much about the Democrats. Now, the ideal, the real support for H-1B program should have actually come from Republicans. Because based on their core conservative principles of free markets and the free movement of goods and human and goods and services, the H-1B program makes perfect capitalist sense for them, because it's true. The H-1B program allows the U.S. and allows U.S. industry to get very qualified individuals at less than what they would have to pay. Let's accept that. At less than what they would have to pay if they did not have this program, if they had to hire from among the U.S. citizens. It's not true that they are not U.S. qualified people. That is not true. It's just that they would have to pay orders of magnitude more. And that makes sense in a global, and this is exactly the way U.S. companies also operate in other countries. So there's nothing unfair about this in a global capitalist system. So just like GM has every right to get their cars manufactured in Mexico because it's cheaper there, they have every right to import highly skilled labor that is as good or better than what they would get here for a fraction of that cost. So for people who support free markets, this should be a slam dunk. So the support should have ideally come from Republicans. However, and when I say Republicans, I am leaving aside fraud Republicans like Trump, who are essentially protectionists. So with respect to industrial policy, Trump is very similar to Bernie Sanders in many ways. So if you leave aside the fraud Republicans like Trump, this should have been a Republican issue. However, the Republicans, this desire is also, there's also this very strong xenophobia and, you know, essentially, you know, Western Europe, Western civilization, Caucasian supremacy that they also have, which kind of counterbalances in this case their desire for a program like H-1B. So on one hand, there is this, yes, free movement of goods and services, but I don't know about these guys. I mean, if these guys were from Ireland or Norway, then it would have been great, but I don't think. That's the problem with the Republicans. So they kind of can't balance those two. But what about Democrats who are all for diversity and who all, this should be also be their issue. But over there, the second thing comes in is that for progressive Democrats, Indians, especially Hindu Indians, we represent the punch up category. We are not the people who, this is a almost bizarrely ironic, you know, basically, this is almost schizophrenic in this respect, in that on one hand, they want to patronize Indians. You know, you go and make, you know, first have, you know, toilets in your home and then think about going to the moon. On the other hand, you know, Indians who come here, they are considered to be extremely privileged people and the kind of people that Americans don't really want. You know, this is not something which they, you know, that they really care for. Even the progressive Democrats don't really care for, you know, the software engineers. No, they don't really care for them. They care for refugees. They would more care for Rohingyas or, you know, anybody who's coming from a refugee. They are, you see, that kind of worldview is that America is a savior for people. If you're coming here to be saved, we will help you, we'll save you, we'll bless you. But if you're coming here to be our equal, no, sir, you can't come here. So that's what guides them. They are willing to shelter people. They're much more willing inherently than Republicans to open their doors for the weak and the dispossessed. But when people come here, not as weak and dispossessed, but people who come here for as their equal, saying that we are as good as you. We're not coming here because we're unfortunate. We're not coming here because our country has turned us out. None of this. We are coming here because we believe that we can make more money in this place. We are as good as you are, And not only will we make money, we'll set up new companies, we'll set up new things. And this is a place where we believe that we have more opportunity for ourselves to grow. But we're not saying that when we're not holding our hands in a folded gesture and asking you and begging you to let us in, we're not the huddled masses that the Statue of Liberty talks about. We're not escaping from anywhere. We actually, you know, love our country. We might even go back to our country. There's nothing wrong with our country. That is something which the Democrats just cannot wrap their minds around. Those kinds of quote-unquote immigrants. So this is reason why, from a very fundamental point of view, that H-1B and the green card program, and we'll talk more about the details about why it's such a clusterfuck in the next episode, is that it's so stuck between the ideologies of these two of the American, in the two of the big American parties. On one hand, there's this party which is fundamentally against any kind of foreigners. And that's the Republican Party, which, again, as I said, should have been the biggest proponents for the H-1B program and for qualified immigrants. They should have been.
And it was that way during the George Bush days, right? I mean,
no, George Bush made things really tough. Really, really.
The Father George Bush.
Father George Bush was a compassionate Republican. He was again for open borders in terms of, Hispanic and that kind of thing. So he was one of the first. He was known as a company. So the Bushes in general have had this record of being very soft on quote unquote borders. This was the reason why Jeb Bush was devastated by Trump, because in front of a hawk on illegal immigration, they cannot stand up to that, because the Bushes as a family have a very, let's say, checkered record in terms of hardcore Republicans in terms of their immigration policies. Not immigration policies, legal immigration policies. No, not that. So the Bushes were actually, if there was any kind of relaxation, it was happened during Obama era, in which, for instance, the spouses of H-1Bs were allowed to work. Some limited amount of relief was given during Obama era, but even then it was nothing. It was nothing. The fact that Indians have to wait for decades now to get a green card, even the Obama administration did nothing. And these were, again, things which they could have done very easily. They chose not to do this. They deliberately chose not to do this. The Republicans have chosen not to do this. The Democrats have chosen not to do this. The Republicans have chosen not to do this because of that, because of their worldview of what America is and what America should be and their concepts of purity. And for Democrats, it has been Indians. That's been their problem. The Democrats have stood for instance, for making more visas given through the lottery system, for family immigration. These are, again, things which the Democrats are very, very strong on, but they are extremely, extremely weak on employer-based STEM visas, STEM path to citizenships. No, they've never really come out and say we're against it. Obviously, they'll say, no, we want skilled individuals, and everybody says that, even the Republicans say that. But when push comes to shove, you'll find the Democrats are as intransigent on this issue as the Republicans. For this reason and for this reason only, that they just cannot fundamentally support people who are coming here as equals in a way and are not really asking for shelter in that respect. They just feel, I don't know, it comes from, I guess, kaun hai ye aadmi, that kind of thing. So that's why I think, this is not something we should be discussing next time. We'll be discussing more about like the more nuts and bolts of this whole thing when we have experts here. But I just wanted to get this across, because this is, again, my personal hypothesis, having been here for the last 20 years and having seen, I have been very lucky that I haven't been, that I never suffered from this system, because I had my green card through the EB1 category, which is in the category which doesn't have a wait list. And it was I got it through outstanding researcher. So this is, again, a very, very select system. And I was lucky that I was able to get through it. I had to give like 10 recommendation letters from professors all over the world. as well as from people in the federal government to show, you know, that my research is not this, that I have published stuff, which is again in public record, but that my research was being actually used by other people, which is really what they want to see. It's not that they just want to see whether you've done research, but whether your research is actually of any practical use and has been used in any other context. So that is what you have to establish. So again, these are very restrictive visas, and they're given after, like, it's almost like a tenure application. So my whole application packet was like 250 to 300 pages, if I recall. So I didn't have to go through this, but I have seen and I have obviously followed the kind of sheer indignities that I wouldn't use the indignity that people have to face. You know, there are so many people who have gone to India to get their visa stamped, like paying rent over here. They had no idea when they were going that they won't be able to come back. They have children here who are possibly staying with the husband or staying with the wife. They cannot come back. They have, so in the middle of a, you know, a disease like this, it's not even normal times. I mean, for a country to do this to human beings, it's just unbelievable that a country can do this. And this is not big news in India, in the US. Nobody, you know, very few people care for this. In contrast, when Trump imposed this ban on certain Muslim countries, this was like wall-to-wall coverage of that. I remember I was coming back from India, and when this thing was announced, and O'Hare Airport, I used to stay in Chicago at that time, was like chock-a-block full of lawyers coming there to work pro bono for people who were stuck. I have not seen anything close to this for H-1Bs, Indians who have been stranded in India, or for F-1Bs. Yes, universities have said we will file a lawsuit. And universities will file a lawsuit because it's ultimately they who will be losing on tuition. So yeah, I can understand that. But that kind of groundswell of progressive support for, I haven't seen that. I mean, it's only Indians who are even talking about it. I don't see anybody else in the mainstream media even talking about it. Most people don't even know this, that they have done this, which is a far more cruel thing than anything the Trump administration has done so far to immigrants. They have singled out principally Indian immigrants because they are the most number of people for the H-1B programs. And they're the ones who suffered because since they're the only country with a backlog of almost 20 years, they are the people who have to keep on extending their H-1Bs. Other countries don't have to go through this. So this is something which disproportionately affects Indian immigrants. And there has been very little. There's been no outrage from the Ocasio-Cortezes of the world. You're otherwise always on the front page on things like this. There's been nothing from Ilhan Omar. There's nothing from the progressive Democrats. There's nothing from the traditional Democrats. And obviously the Republicans will not say anything. That's a given on this. So this is exactly why this is an issue that never is going to get solved, because there is really no political will to solve this. They actually, both political parties, without accepting this, actually want this situation to go on. Both of them have a vested interest in making this situation go on. And it just targets a very, very small people. And of course, many people who listen to this podcast, I know that are people who are going to get affected. So that's why I wanted to highlight this, because it's of interest to my listeners. But again, that's why I'm spending so much time on this. But I see that in the US media, this doesn't get any attention at all compared to what misery it is causing people here for absolutely no reason. Law-abiding, tax-paying citizens, immigrants who have obeyed every letter of the law, they are the persons who are being victimized, humiliated, and being made to go through this at a time of a global epidemic. This is not even a normal time. You know, have some fucking mercy, man. So this is this place. This government has no mercy. And even the opposition of this government has no mercy either when it comes to Indian immigrants in the US. So with that, I will end my podcast for today.
Yep. And while we're doing that, a reminder to rate our podcast on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to it. Every review and a 5-star rating helps. So even if you don't want to take the time out to actually type in a review, just leave us a 5-star rating. It really helps. And also a shout out to all the 50 plus Patreons who are directly supporting Arnab. And please consider supporting the podcast directly at patreon.com/greatbong. And yeah, that's all for now. Wear a mask, keep your distance, but also live your life and stay healthy and happy. Take care.
Bye.